Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to episode 2 of Ritual Realities here on the Bethel Podcast Network. My name is Ben Kreshtool, and I'm here joined with Rabbi Schwartz, Senior Rabbi of Bethel Congregation. And we're here to talk, Rabbi, welcome, about the rapidly upcoming Passover holiday. And I don't know about you, but nothing gives me anxiety more than this holiday.
Well, there's a lot involved in it. You know, of all the holidays that we celebrate in terms of preparation, pre-holiday preparation, schlepping, effort, energy, you know, also while you're trying to do all of the stuff that's involved in creating a kosher for Passover home, you're also trying to plan to have dinner for, you know, 20 people or 25 people. Some people I know have seders for 30, 35, 40 people. So it's just a lot that logistically is involved in getting ready for the holiday. It's interesting, you know, it's interesting in that respect because traditionally there was this sort of preparatory phase for Pesach, which included the special Shabbatot leading up to it, you know, Shabbat Shekalim, Shabbat Parah, Shabbat Achodesh particularly, and then Birkat Chametz, Bior Chametz. I mean, all that stuff is Pesach prep, and you know, at the end of the day, and so it does reflect and echo our own sometimes frantic preparations here. You know, it happens in the shul. You know, there's a lot of preparation that needs to be done in the shul, kosher in the kitchens, and the whole rigmarole, and at home too. I mean, it's the schlepping of the dishes and all that stuff.
It strikes me kind of as a little odd that, you know, here we are schlepping and doing all of these things, and like this is a holiday that's supposed to celebrate liberation and freedom, and you sort of find yourself, you know, attached to the kitchen or attached to your house, you know, doing all of these things, and it's, I don't know, it's a lot.
Well, but you know, I think that reflects that whole sense of, you know, what is Yitziat Mitzrayim? It's freedom to work for God, basically.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
And work we do. It is a work intensive holiday.
Is it your favorite holiday?
I do love Pesach. I mean, I love the Seders. You know, for me, that's a combination of a lot of very sweet family memories I have growing up. And contemporary seders for me with family and friends coming over to celebrate, and so it's a fun holiday. It's very obviously family oriented holiday. I happen to love the food, you know, like I.
Does that include matzah?
Well, so when I say I love the food, I say that actually with some ambivalence. if that's not oxymoronic, because I love the food of the seders. After about 3 or 4 days, you know, in the keeping kosher for Passover week, I'm not happy about it. I'm done with it already. Matzah, I could take it or leave it. I mean, you know, I eat it throughout the 8 days because you kind of almost have to, but I wouldn't say I'm a matzah lover. Mm. You know. How about you?
No. I mean, I have like a very difficult relationship with matzah. So a lot of like the non-Jewish people I know, and I don't actually know that many non-Jewish people, but the few that I do know, they all love matzah. And I've always sort of look at them with like this tilted head and be like, why do you love it? And I realize, of course, they don't have a sacred obligation to eat it, you know, as much as we have to eat it. And they can put whatever they want on it, right? You know, and they don't have to think about any of those things. And I guess at the end of the day, really just another sort of tasteless cracker. Right. And, you know, you can do anything with a cracker. But for me, I adhere to some pretty strict beliefs about matzah. Like, I do not eat it outside of the month of Nisan. I don't really even eat it outside of the holiday of Passover because I do grant it such an exalted status, except for on Pesach Sheni, when I will eat reluctantly a piece of matzah as well to remind myself of you know, the ancient times. But yeah, I don't, I did discover a couple of years ago, soft matzah. which is prevalent in Sephardic and Yemenite traditions. Right. A little thicker. It's the same shmorah flour that you get from shmorah matzah. It only is rolled out a little thicker, and then depending on your minhag, right? And here, I just want to be clear. These are minhagim. These are not halachot regarding matzah. Matzah, the halacha of matzah is just, you know, can't rise for more than 18 minutes. Water and flour, zo, right? But there are minhagim, these customs from different parts of the world. So in Sephardic communities, it was common, and the Shulchan Aruch talks about how thick matzah can be. And, of course, the gloss on the Shulchan Aruch talks about how thin it must be in Eastern European communities. So it's the same ingredients. It's just a matter of the thickness of the matzah. Does it make it a little more bearable? I guess, maybe. I don't know. It's like a pita-ish.
Well, that Yemeni matzah is a little, it's pita-ish. Exactly.
Yeah.
It's kind of like
pita. Which I think is really closer to authentic matzah, what probably our ancestors were schlepping out of Mitzrayim.
Probably.
Like, let's
because
be
they didn't have any machines that were pressing it.
Right.
Know? There was no. So, yeah. Yeah, I mean. And then, you know, it just gets, for me, just gets a little tiring with the, you know, what do you eat for breakfast? Like, what do you eat for breakfast on Passover? Matzah and jam? You know, matzah and butter and jam? Matzah brai? I mean, after a while, you're like, oh, my God, give me a bowl of cereal. That's day three, right? There you go. You got 3 days. But the Seder food I love. I love, you know, brisket and turkey. I just think there's so many wonderful traditions. And the text of the Haggadah itself is so rich. And you know, thinking about what makes a text important in Judaism? And if one of the answers to that question is the familiarity that the common Jew has with the text, the Haggadah is one of the most important texts. You know, I would say probably the Haggadah and the Siddur are the two most important texts.
Yeah.
And the Haggadah is a wonderful, amazing text, amazing text.
It is an amazing text, a fascinating text, especially when you look at it through the lens of the Gemara and the Mishnah. You can really see how ancient the text itself is and how the Seder and the text of the Haggadah has really remained the same for a really, really long time. I mean, we're talking at least, you know,
almost 2,000
years. Yeah, almost 2,000 years is really where we are at this point. And I think that's incredible. I always am sort of struck by things that are so ancient. And then what's a powerful thing for me is understanding that I am sort of this link in this chain that goes back that far, knowing that there are ancestors that I have had that had recited the same words, you know, at a Seder table 2,000 years ago, whatever, which I find very powerful. You know, connection to text and connection to God.
I agree.
Do you have a favorite part of the Haggadah?
I mean, I have a number of different favorite parts of the Haggadah.
If you had to choose one.
You know, I love the Pesach Matzah Maror section and then the Hillel sandwich section. I love that.
Weird to talk about a sandwich with no bread.
Yeah, yeah. I love, you know, I love also like the four children section, Abadim. I just, you know, the whole text is amazing. I love how Hallel is woven into it. Every layer of it is just amazing to me. And I love how the, you know, as you referenced earlier, that the Mishnaic text, literally like mamash, the words of the Mishnah, really form the core of the Haggadah in a lot of ways, and how brilliant the rabbis were to use that core text. The Mishnaic text can often be very dry, and yet still today, here it is, 2,000 years, you know, after the text was
living and breathing.
Absolutely.
Very incredible to me. Yeah. I agree.
What are your favorite passages?
I also am fascinated by the Haggadah as a text. My favorite part is the Shvoch HaMatcha part, where we talk about our enemies. I know it's kind of weird, but I really love sort of that scene. And you have to sort of think about it. Actually, you have to go back in time to understand sort of why this piece of the Haggadah exists. I know there's a lot of people that sort of like gloss over it or like skip it entirely or just sort of like see this as this archaic relic. Which in some ways it is, but that moment, you know, right when we're opening up our doors and right, Elijah is there, but, you know, there's also sort of like a seedy sort of undertext to that. And one of the reasons why we're opening our doors is because of the blood libel, right? We had to open up our doors and let our neighbors see that we weren't murdering babies under the Seder table, right? And had to, you know, sort of to put ourselves in our ancestors' shoes and understand that even this joyous festival of freedom sometimes had to be celebrated in such a, you know, like a, you know, under the watchful eye of our Christian oppressors. Like, it's a, you know, it's a weird sort of thing for me. And that paragraph sort of, I see it as almost like a liberation sort of paragraph to sort of, you know, take back some of what, you know, is originally ours and hasn't been perverted for anti-Semitic purposes. And, you know, in Pesach, there's a lot of that, you know, history there that is, you know, it's hard. It's hard.
Yeah.
Hard history. But that paragraph, but also I love all the songs at the end. I love all of the songs. Adir Hu is my favorite Pesach song, obviously, because it's about the temple. But I love all of the songs because they're all allegories. I love allegories.
Right.
Like, I'm really into like allegorical songs. I think that I love when like the Pew team and like the authors of these medieval poems and these songs sort of like were able to create, you know, these, you know, what are essentially sort of fun little songs. But if you dig, you know, a little deeper, you'll find a really like beautiful expression of survival and freedom and Jewish community. And I really like that a lot. Like, I think it's really a nice way to celebrate the holiday, to sort of have this sort of these little secrets, you know, peppered in there. I love. And then I just love Haggadahs in general. Like, for as much as the text is the same, I love how varied and different Haggadot can be, and the way people who edit them and create them have chosen to sort of express in artistic ways
different,
you know,
themes, ideas.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's interesting along those lines. As you know, I met with the Lapid kids yesterday. These are the young people who are preparing for Bi Mitzvah, and so it's that mostly seventh grade is kind of the sweet spot there. And we spent an hour in my office looking through Haggadot, and they loved it. The kids loved it. Now, we had those two special Haggadot. We had the Moss and the Agam.
Moss Haggadah, I think, is the most beautiful Haggadah ever created.
It's amazing. Yeah. Incredible. And we talked about how Rabbi Loeb was a Haggadah collector. And how I was wondering, actually, you know, when he purchased those Haggadot originally, what did he pay for them originally? You know?
Yeah, that's an interesting question.
but they've become quite valuable. Really, really museum. Valuable. They're like museum pieces. I also love in the Haggadah the text of the sages at B'nai Barak. That's a great
Well, that's
text.
Great, too, because, you know, you got a lot of fun, like, Jewish history there, stuff about the Bar Kokhba revolt. And as you know, I believe Bar Kokhba was the Messiah. So I also really am attached to that piece as well. Do you have a favorite Haggadah?
I don't have a favorite Haggadah per se. No. I mean, I love so the other piece of Passover that I really love is the study of the text, and and I love the Kasher Haggadah.
Menachem Kasher.
Menachem Kasher.
That's a great Haggadah.
I mean, all it is just commentaries.
I know, but it's a great commentary.
But I love the commentaries in there. Yeah, it's only available in Hebrew, as far as I know, and I spend a lot of time on Passover with that book. But we use the conservative movement.
Yeah, no, Feast of Freedom is a great Haggadah.
Has nice commentary.
It's a beautiful commentary.
It's got a full text. It's got some interesting, although maybe at this point dated artwork. I guess it's paper cut.
Very paper cut. I love this Haggadah also, but I think if I had to sort of choose, and there's like a lot of beautiful, like, illuminated Haggadot from over the years. The Sarajevo, I think, for me is like because I love what it sort of, in the beginning of it, it sort of has these illustrations that start at the creation of the world and go all the way through, like, Moshe, like, to there before they start the Haggadah. And that, like, medieval art style from Spain is very unique. And I think it's just sort of fun to.
Someone gave me a copy of that for my bar mitzvah.
Oh, really?
Yeah, which was few years ago, but I still have it. It's in my office.
Yeah, it's a nice, it's a beautiful, beautiful Haggadah, again, that also has itself a very unique history, you know, that it survived for as long as it has.
Speaking of Moses, two things. So oddly, Moses's name, so talking with the kids yesterday, and before we started looking at the Haggadot, I said to them, so tell me what's in a Haggadah, you know, and one of the kids said, oh, well, it's the story of Passover and Moses taking the people and Pharaoh and all this stuff. And I said, that's true, except, oddly and interestingly, Moses' name is not found in the Haggadah, which is surprising when you think about it. And then the other thing about Moses is someone said to me there's a new Netflix series about Moses. Do you know about this?
No.
Jeremy.
But I am a huge fan of biblical-inspired TV or movies.
So this will be for you.
Well, it's not always done well. Is my problem.
Sometimes the worse done it is, the better.
So the Ten Commandments, I think, is a really good example. It's not a biblically accurate movie, but it is a fantastic
Charlton Heston.
Epic movie. Oh, yeah. It's a great movie, but it has a lot of issues.
Jeremy's checking. Jeremy, we have Jeremy behind the glass today. Jeremy. And he's checking. Testament, the story of Moses. That's a new, see, we'll have to.
Testament, the story of Moses.
But what is your sense that Moses is not mentioned in the Haggadah?
So I think that that's a really sort of deliberate, obviously, decision on the part of our sages who I think, and again, you have to sort of put yourself in our rabbis' minds, right? So in their minds, I think they also believed very strongly that the temple was going to be rebuilt in their day. I think they really believed that. And I think, you know, in doing so, I think in the time when the Haggadah, the text was sort of being created, we really wanted to focus a lot more on God's role in taking us out of Egypt, because it really was God who took us out of it. And Moses sort of was at the head of the column, but it was God who led us out through that outstretched arm and that, you know, with all of the wonders and the signs. It was all God, and I think we... and also, you know, some of our brethren in other faith traditions tend to put human beings up on a sort of this divine pedestal. And I think for us, we want to acknowledge, one, the humanity of Moses, right? Moses was a human being, a flawed, very flawed human being, right? But also to take God out of the equation is problematic theologically. So I think that that's really sort of one of the main reason why Moses... And I think were you to ask Moses, I think he would be okay with it. I think he would be like, yeah, I think that this is really fine for me to not be in here, because I think he would give credit to God.
I'm thinking somewhere in there, because it's hard not to think about Moses' absence from the Haggadah and God's absence from the Megillah, the Book of Esther. And somewhere in there, there's a sermon.
I think,
you know. There's always a sermon, Jeremy. There's always a sermon. So, you know, what would that sermon? Well, so, I mean, just, so you can ask the question, which world would you rather live in? Would you rather live in a world without God or without Moses? You know, that's an interesting question.
That is an interesting question.
I'll forget it, of course.
this might be your sermon.
It might be, or it will never be given because I'll completely forget it.
Oh, I'll remind you.
You'll remind me. But that's okay, if I can remember that, maybe something could come of that. And any favorite Passover rituals, minhagim, traditions, customs?
You go first, and I'll
out of it. I mean, I like bidikat chametz, bior chametz, that kind of, again, like we were saying before, that sort of preparatory phase. I have a kind of a love-hate relationship with the koshering of the kitchen.
Yes, I think everybody has. Who does that?
It's not the koshering of the kitchen. Okay, like, you know, in the end of the day, it doesn't take too long. If you have granite counters,
it's super nice, right?
Yeah, and if you use self-cleaning ovens, and it's not terrible. That what I really struggle with is the schlepping of the dishes.
Yeah,
because it's not just that you got to schlep. We keep the Pesach dishes in the basement.
Yeah,
fine, but it's you got to put the other dishes somewhere too. It's not like, you know. So that whole thing is really,
yeah.
But by and large, you know, it's a wonderful holiday, filled with all of these things. So full, it's so rich, symbolism, the foods, the difference with the difference of the dishes and all that kind of stuff. One thing we have to talk about, though, which we haven't spoken about yet, and that is, what does one drink during the 8 days of Passover?
Yeah, well, that's easy. You drink shlivovitz on Pesach.
So first of all, what's chametz? This is an interesting thing. Chametz, of course, is what you can't have on Passover. Now, people often mistakenly think that chametz is something with yeast in it.
Yeah, that's not.
That's not true.
True.
What chametz, what you cannot have is, you can have grain. How do we know that? We have matzah. Matzah is made of grain. You can have yeast. How do we know that, Jeremy, that you can have yeast? How do we know it? Because you can have wine on Passover. There's yeast in wine. What you cannot have is a combination of the grain and the yeast.
Right.
That's chametz. So just, you know, there's that, like to make sure that we say that. But you can have wine to drink during Passover.
It is, I would argue, mandatory to have wine on
mandatory
Passover.
To have wine, certainly at the Sedarim. You can have shlivovitz. It's become a classic Passover drink, Eastern
Although,
European plum brandy.
I will say that shlivovitz is a drink for all seasons.
I would agree with that. I do drink shlivovitz throughout the year.
I
would agree
with that. As do I, as you know.
You can also these days you can get kosher Passover vodka.
Is that potato right. vodka?
Potato
yeah,
vodka.
Yeah, that's that real Russian stuff.
Now.
You can
You have yeah. my attention now.
Jeremy, for those of you you're just listening, you can't. Jeremy just woke up. He's been sound asleep. He just woke up. So you can also have kosher for Passover cognac.
Yeah. Yeah.
You can have kosher for Passover tequila.
Tequila. I'm a fan of tequila.
And our resident Bethel whiskey expert, Arthur Ferguson, has told us that he found this year a kosher Le Pesach whiskey.
I'm suspicious of it.
I'm a little suspicious as well, but he assures he assures us that it has hashgacha, and it's whiskey made from sorghum, which is a kind of grain, but not one of the five grains.
I don't think it's really a grain. I think sorghum is really like a grass of some kind.
Oh, yeah.
I think.
Okay.
There was a book called Red Sorghum, was written by a Chinese author whose name escapes me at the moment, and I'm pretty sure he was sent away for writing it. But I think it won a Pulitzer. Red Sorghum.
Red, and it was about
communism. I don't know.
Well, we'll have to keep folks posted on the sorghum whiskey.
I don't think I'm going to drink.
I don't have high hopes.
No, me either.
A few years ago, there was a whiskey that was being sold as a kosher for Passover whiskey, and it was like a cane sugar.
Oh, fine.
you know, liquor that had been distilled from cane sugar, and it had been put into wooden barrels to age, and it gave it a little bit of a brown color. A little bit of flavor. It was pretty nasty stuff.
Yeah. I remember there was a couple years ago that Pesach beer that sometimes shows up in Israel that sometimes is good or sometimes bad. You know what they do have in Israel, although I don't know if anymore because there were, you know, some issues. But there used to be, there was charoset ice cream that would come out every
charoset ice cream?
Yeah.
Ooh, boy. That sounds good.
It does sound good. I mean, I'm a fan of ice cream.
That's like something that the what's the ice cream place in Hamden? The Charmery?
Yeah, Charmery.
Hamden and Towson, I believe.
The Charmery. They would make because they do the Old Bay
yeah.
ice cream.
Well, I think one of them is a graduate of Bethephila.
Really?
Yeah, I think they're one of them is a BT kid. I'm pretty sure.
So there you go. So they should have charoset ice cream.
Well, we should mention it to them.
And charoset, what recipe or?
I like a when it turns into like a paste and is made with dates. I'm a bit like Ceylon date syrup, big into that type of charoset, which you can find common in, you know, Spanish communities typically.
Right.
But it's delicious. I like charoset. I remember. I think I had an argument once with somebody on whether charoset actually has to be on the Seder plate or not. And the Gemara has an interesting what to say about that. Chazeret, yes. Charoset, no.
Yeah, it's Eina Mitzvah. I think.
Yeah, it is Eina Mitzvah.
And then the last thing, kidneyot, you'll eat kidneyot?
Yes, everybody should eat kidneyot. The Torah says you can eat kidneyot. Anybody who says you can't eat kidneyot, read.
So why do Ashkenazic Jews, by and large, not eat kidneyot?
The nice answer or the mean answer? I know. I think that they're it's a derivative of to be extra careful, right? To be so extra careful, you know, we sort of put this fence around kidneyot, right? These legumes, which could,
because they swell,
right,
some of them
potentially, you know, cause issues. But the Torah does not forbid it, right? It is kidneyot are not forbidden to eat on Pesach.
Clearly, no.
Clearly. Right. This is again a minhag that somehow for some people have turned into halacha, which I think problematic.
So in my family, we're having a debate because a couple of the kids are exploring what it, the idea of possibly eating kidneyot on Pesach, which traditionally we have not done in my house anyway. So we'll see. We'll keep you posted and let you know how that works out. But at the end of the day, even if you don't eat kidneyot, there's no issue if you have kidneyot on your dishes or whatever on Pesach. No. It's just not. Jeremy's pulling up kosher for Passover whiskey articles on the internet here.
I'm not going to read that. That's too long.
That could be the next podcast episode for a tasting kind of thing.
All right, I could be into that.
You wouldn't have to cook anything. You just crack open the whiskey bottles. It could be one of the funnier podcasts, actually.
I think we might have some new Passover programming coming up after this podcast.
After this podcast, there you go.
Well, whatever you do and whatever your family traditions, I think one of the things that makes Pesach great is everybody has their own family traditions.
Yeah.
I hope that this holiday will be a meaningful one for everybody. I know it's sort of like a weird year, what with going on in the world, and I think that Pesach will give us an opportunity to sort of reflect on that and really think about, all of the blessings that exist in our lives. And should be a Chag Kasher V'Sameach for you, Rabbi, and for all of the people who are listening to our podcast. And hopefully we will see you in services. Make sure you check all of your emails and whatnot to see what time all of those things will be.
All right. Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach. Everybody, you've been listening to Ritual Realities on the Bethel Podcast Network. You can find all of our shows wherever you go to listen to your favorite podcasts. And remember to follow us on all of our social media platforms, including Facebook and Instagram, also TikTok. Just search for Beth El Balto. So thanks again for listening, everybody, and Chag Sameach.